Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Guy Kingston from the Bristol branch of the Federation of Small Businesses. No MP or councillor this week then, but as the politicians take their August break in Westminster and here at the Bristol Council House too, so we will be taking a break from them. Just before the 6 o'clock news, in the week that's seen another mysterious bomb go off in Northern Ireland in the marching season, Drive Time's Richard Cowley takes a close look at who does the marching, why they do it, and why more is not being done to prevent these provocative marches. And former BBC South and West Request Show presenter Helen Reid will be joining us after six to talk about bullying in the workplace. How do you know if you're being bullied? And if you are, what can you do? That's in the second hour. Well, on to this week's news in a minute, but first, our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures highs of around 21 degrees Celsius, fairly wet on Saturday, sunny on Sunday. Next week, highs again around 21, warming up and getting sunnier as the week goes on. Some showers at the beginning of the week. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of August, highs of around 23, so even warmer, fairly sunny and dry all weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest now, and with me is Guy Kingston from the Bristol branch of the Federation of Small Businesses. Hello, Guy, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, tell us first of all, you're from the Federation of Small Businesses. What is your business?
My business is the production of website promo videos for smallish companies.
And what sort of clients have you got?
Lots of different small businesses. An art gallery, a framing shop, a small car manufacturer.
And why is this kind of business? It sounds like something fairly new. Is this something that a lot of new businesses are happy to take on with the internet and with changes in the way that they're marketing?
Yes, well, in the 90s, websites were just text and then pictures appeared and we've had YouTube. And in the next 2, 3, 5 years, most people are going to feel they need some sort of video on their website for it to look modern and up to date. So I'm trying to position myself ready to give them a brilliant video.
Well, now, one of the things we keep hearing the last few weeks is that the banks aren't lending to, particularly to small businesses. So what's the Federation's position on that?
Well, the Federation would like to see banks lending to our members who need to borrow. There's a debate going on as to whether people really do want to borrow that much. I think a lot of small businesses are actually using this as an opportunity to pay down their credit lines they've already got, build up some cash reserves, and not be so beholden to credit lines from the banks in the future.
Now, the Bank of England's interest rates are being kept yesterday down at this all-time low. Are the banks sort of passing that on to businesses? Or are they using it as an opportunity to make money?
Well, if you could borrow money at 0.5% or even 1%, that would just be brilliant. And I think actually we could run into economic problems with that as people would just borrow simply too much. So I think the market is kicking in and loans to businesses are being set probably at fairly sensible rates. I think the problem arises because lending was too easy. It was too easy to get credit before. Now we're back to a more sensible set of conditions, though those people who could have got credit before who don't get it now are going to be the vociferous ones saying, hey, it's not fair.
Now, as a bit of an insider, can you give us a picture of what's going on in the Bristol and the surrounding area with small businesses?
Well, we've got a fairly resilient, dare I say, thriving economy here. I think Bristol's going to do fairly well compared with a lot of regions around the country.
So why is that? What makes Bristol different?
I think we've got some dynamic entrepreneurs. We've got a good industrial mix, for want of a better word. Sounds a very 70s expression, doesn't it? We've got a good different mix of industries. We have a good strong media industry here. We've got quite a few high-tech businesses in the locality, so they're well positioned to help develop economic growth as we come out of the recession. And we, the FSB, the Federation of Small Businesses, have been working very closely with the council, and we have a very good relationship for first time in a long time with Bristol City Council to make sure that council policies are business friendly. It's not that they ever intended them not to be, but when we are able to say, actually, have you thought through this impact? Have you thought through that impact? We can get a better outcome for everybody.
Now, we see it on the high street and we see it on industrial estates that increasingly it's big multinational companies that are having branches around the country rather than small entrepreneurs. Don't you think ultimately that big business is always going to win? As time goes on, there's going to be more big businesses and multinationals and less small, maybe family businesses and one person operated ones.
Ah, who's supplying those big businesses? Scratch the surface and you'll see that the major supply lines into those big businesses are small businesses. So whereas we might have the odd boutique store, and by definition, once a small business has got stores on every high street, it's no longer a small business. It's one of those national or multinational chains. So we do grow, and some of us break through and get turned into phenomenally huge businesses. But a lot of us are supplying niche specialist services and niche specialist products into these larger companies. So take us away, and those big businesses would just implode.
So anyone with an idea for a small business, how do they know if it's really got any chance of success or not?
Ha ha ha, that's a very, very good question. You do have to rely a certain degree on your own gut feeling. I think the first thing, the most important thing to do is to figure out whether you can really sell your product. And if you can, if there's a genuine market, not just a few friends in the pub saying, yeah, brilliant idea, go for it. But people who owe you nothing, independent people, would they buy your product? If so, at what price? And then can you make it for less than that so you can make a little bit extra for yourself? And if those answers come together and you're the right person to do it, then you're ahead of the game.
And do you then have to sort of take that idea to a banker and manage to twist their arm and convince them that it's, to lend you some money to get things going?
That's one way forward. A lot of people will use friends and family. There is the expression, the three F's, friends, family and fools. So who puts money into a new venture? And the banks don't like to be regarded as fools. So don't forget, the banks are not there to take a risk. They're not investors not buying shares. They're lending money. And they're only going to make 1% or 2% on their loan. So it has to be very low risk for them. And I think most small business owners and entrepreneurs get angry about that because they think the bank should be investing risk capital, and that's not the bank's job.
So whose job is that? You think it's if you can persuade friends to invest a bit in shares rather than to get the money from a bank?
Yeah, well, for a slightly larger concern, a larger startup, it would be angel investors or even venture capitalists. Other than that, it may be the entrepreneur's own resources, savings he's made, money from friends, family. I think it's a good thing to be able to start a business with very little cash. I think that makes you very astute. And the first business I started, I had quite a lot of money to get going with, reasonable sum, but £10,000-£15,000. And it was until I didn't make a penny, until I'd run out, until I couldn't pay the rent at the end of the week, that forced me to sharpen up my ideas. And that's when I became good at what I did.
Now, you mentioned angel investors. Who are they?
Business angels. Well, the term comes from Broadway, where people would invest in new shows, and that spread out into the wider business community. And they tend to be successful business owners, people who have come into a fair amount of money, usually through their own business success, who wish to invest in other businesses. And they take the rather general term angel investors.
Now, what about the Federation of Small Businesses then? How much does it actually cost for people to become a member of it, and what do they get for their money?
It's the annual subscription is £120, and then it's an extra £30 to join, one-time joining fee for your membership pack and various bits of admin. The Federation has a wonderful collection of benefits for members, and the one that's best known and most used is the free legal advice. And if you're a small business, every time you pick up the phone to a solicitor, it's going to cost you £50 or £100. To be able to do that for free and only pay for £120 a year is an absolute bargain. And that's a lot of people join for that. We also lobby. We do a lot. We try to represent business. We're the biggest business membership organisation in the country. And we have a lot of influence, government at national level and at local level. So if businesses need some lobbying doing, they should come to us.
So how come they're not doing so well lobbying the banks to lend via the government at the moment?
Well, the government's making a lot of noises about getting the banks to lend, and the Federation is doing its bit there. We don't have power to force the banks to lend. And I think the banks are moving into a position now where we're getting back to a more normal state of affairs. So I would say the Federation has been reasonably successful in keeping this as a popular top of the agenda item, making sure that it's at the forefront. And if there wasn't all this noise going on, be sure the banks would be lending even less. So it's where on the spectrum you regard the success point. We're certainly better than we would otherwise be.
Okay, and you do a regular podcast, don't you? What kind of stuff do you talk about on that?
I do. Well, I started what I call the Mind Your Own Business podcast back in the very beginning of podcasting in 2005. So I've been going 5 years now. And I do a monthly podcast for business owners and would-be business owners. And we take a different approach. It's not simply one of these extreme marketing and anyone can do it. Highly motivational but a bit unrealistic type shows. We have a discussion as our main feature, myself and a gentleman called John Richards, who wrote The Bluffer's Guide to Small Business. And we take a topic, usually suggested by a listener, and we discuss that in depth for about half an hour every show. And we'll happily tackle listeners' questions and problems and hopefully offer some meaningful advice.
And so where can I find that on the internet?
That is at MYOB, for Mind Your Own Business, POD, .com.
Say that again.
Mike Yankee Oscar Brava Papa Oscar Delta.com.
Lovely. Now, Martin Summer, our old label Oxford Economist, is here too. Martin, the bank's profits have all been announced this week. We're talking tens and tens of billions. So does this mean the recession over, and is this a good thing?
Well, I don't think we can say that the recession is necessarily over.
Surely the banks is that, you know, once the banks have then start being healthy, then they can start lending again. And this is going to slowly filter out to the rest of the economy.
That's the idea. But whether it'll actually work out in that particular way is still open to question. You've got to remember that the banks are still sitting on lots and lots of bad debts. And effectively what they've been doing is keeping two sets of books. The shadow banking system is far bigger than the official banking system, and they've not been marking to market what they're actually holding. So in actual fact, the asset base of the banks has been exaggerated, because a lot of what they're holding isn't in fact worth what they claim it's worth. So when they say they're making a profit, that's a profit on the basis that the assets that they hold are actually what they say they're worth. And in actual fact, it's largely the case that they're not.
But Martin, you've just said, I can't believe my ears, that they keep two sets of books. Now that's fraud.
Well, what's happened in the financial sector over the last generation is the creation of structured investment vehicles, which are off the main. They basically don't get included in the official books, and a lot of what the banks are sitting on is assets which are in fact, you know, collateralized debt obligations and similar these new financial instruments. And of course on the piece of paper that the financial instrument says it's worth X, but in actual fact we all know if there was a market to market that it's probably worth Y and less than the official price that they're offering. And of course they could sell these assets, but they'd make a massive loss if they did. So they're all sitting on these assets, but that of course is the black hole at the heart of the financial system, and nothing that's been done so far has actually tackled it.
Now, I can't wait to get your assessment of this, because on yesterday's Today programme on Radio 4, we had Professor Tim Congdon, who's from Lombard Street Research and apparently a leading economist in London,
monetarist,
actually saying that the banks were not bust. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
These were inherently good businesses with very strong franchises, and their problem was when they were funding their assets. They weren't bust at all. And there's all this nonsense in the media about the banks being bust. They weren't bust, and that's become evident with what's now happening. What they needed was loans from the Bank of England. They did receive such loans. Larger loans for longer period would have been perfectly okay, and there'd have been no need for the injection of capital. It's a different kind of money.
So, Professor Congdon, what about all that stuff that we were told at the time about banks being days from collapsing, that they were bust, effectively bust?
A bank all the time requires, you know, us, the public, to keep our cash there. You know, the British public has around about £800 billion worth of deposits that we can go into our banks and just pull them out now And actually the banks would be bust in the sense that they couldn't pay us back our pound notes. Now please, listeners, don't do that. But they couldn't pay back the pound notes that they owe us. That does not mean our banks are bust, not at all. The problem they had in the end of 2008, and to some extent actually beginning middle of 2007, was they had a cash problem which had been dealt with by loans from the Bank of England, not by these capital injections, and certainly not by the expropriation of shareholders' money in the case of Northern Rock, Grafton and Bingley.
So, Martin, what is the difference between the cash injections that he's talking about there, which was essentially the bailout, and what he's suggesting would have been fine, which is just loans from the Bank of England to rescue the banks?
Well, I find it rather strange. I mean, Tim Congdon has been well known as a monetarist economist over a generation. I mean, he was an advisor to Margaret Thatcher. I think that those remarks are quite extraordinary and rather complacent. I do think that the banks have actually blackmailed, if you like, the taxpayer into bailing them out. The TARP funds in the US being a classic example of this. But on the other hand, the idea that he seems to be suggesting that the banks were insolvent, and I think that they're not. It's a liquidity problem, and I think it's worse than that. I mean, the banks are insolvent; they're not just short of cash. And of course, you've got HSBC, which never took any direct cash from the government, and they're claiming that they made $7 billion profit. But of course, the whole system has been propped up. HSBC is owed money by the other banks, which have taken money from the governments, and it's all of a piece. You know, in actual fact, the financial system is disintermediated together. So banks owe.
What do you mean by that? Well, they're disintermediated.
Well, they actually owe each other lots of money, and they won't. And what was happening in the capital markets when we had the credit crunch is that banks were not prepared to lend each other money because they were too scared of what was in the closet, and of course the real root of this has been these financial innovations, which basically are, many of them are effectively insurance contracts, but they're not, you can take out an insurance contract, which is not actually, where you haven't actually got an insured interest. So I can actually bet on whether your business is going to fail. Now, can you see what the moral problem is? If I'm betting on your business failing, is that I'm actually quite keen for you to fail if I've made such a bet. And of course, that's part of the problem. This whole new, in the past, an insurance company would have to actually have an insurable interest. It's my ship, I'm insuring it to make sure it doesn't stink. But now, effectively, you can take bets on virtually anything. And of course, as the market goes down, if you've shorted the market, you're going to make money. So I think the parasitic nature of the financial system is very clear in these profit figures that they're showing. I mean, they are booming, but the economy is still stuttering.
Now, Guy, I wonder what your thoughts are on this, because there is a sort of two completely separate types of banking, and one is this investment banking market Martin's talking about there, where you're kind of betting on these international markets, and the other, you need obviously to be retail, much more stable, which is the real banking where money's being lent to small businesses like yours. Do you think that it's actually clear enough for most business owners what's going on?
Well, I used to be an investment banker back in the late 80s and early 90s. I wasn't a very good investment banker, which is why I became an entrepreneur instead. But I think for the most part, people love to hate the banks at the moment. And I think whatever the banks do, they're just going to be beaten up on. I personally think it's good news that those banks that are owned by the shareholder, by the taxpayer, or largely owned by the taxpayer, are making good profits, hopefully. The government will be able to sell their stake in a few years' time for a massive profit, and will look back on this and say it was horrible at the time, but we've done quite well out of it. And if you've got a business that's struggling and you need a bank loan, you're going to hate every bank manager who turns you down. If you have taken a very prudent attitude and never borrowed money, and you're watching your insolvent competitors go out of business and you're picking up their customers, you'll be cheering on those bank managers.
Okay, the next story is we're going on to WikiLeaks now, and this is the 92,000 secret documents which were posted about 10 days ago up on the internet. We have a little clip now with one of the chaps who founded WikiLeaks. His name is John Young. He used to run a website, I can remember from years ago, 1996 roughly, called Cryptome, which was a leak website. And how he explains how he was approached and how WikiLeaks was founded.
got an email from an anonymous source who said there was an intention to set up something that was not yet named WikiLeaks, but described the intent, and that the people who are going to be running this did not want to be publicly known and asked me to serve as the public face on it for the registration of the website. I've had these kind of requests before, and I'm happy to do it. I don't mind being the public face. And so I said, sure, I'll be glad to do that. And so that was the start. That person who wrote me eventually identified himself as Julian Assange, but he was cautious even then about identifying him and what he was up to. And so after that, I was put on a private mail list at which the operation of WikiLeaks was discussed and how they'd go about it. No one ever identified themselves on that list. They all used pseudonyms.
Now that was Cryptome's John Young, who was one of the founding members of WikiLeaks, but then pulled out because he was worried that it was getting all these massive amounts of money. Now, Martin, can I just get your take on the WikiLeaks leak, if I can call it that?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a massive amount of material there, and I haven't been through all of it. I've read selected bits of it in the press and on the internet. I mean, to be honest with you, a lot of what's come out we pretty much knew already. I mean, didn't we know that there were civilians dying in Afghanistan? I think we should have known that if we didn't. And of course, a lot of it seems to be low-level intelligence gossip. So, you know, you can't actually, just because there's a document saying that some low-level intelligence operative thinks that something may be happening, that doesn't mean that it is happening, it just means that they're gossiping about it.
Well, the concern here is that it does seem to be a lot of stuff on there on the in this leak that actually is really against Pakistan. Mike Rivero, who runs whatreallyhappened.com, yeah, made the following comment. It may be noted that among the over 92,000 secret documents compiled in 5 years, there's not a single line written about India. The documents are silent about the role of RAW, RAW, RAAM and Mossad in destabilising Pakistan. Nobody in the USA and the entire Western world has noticed these glaring oddities as to how come the role of three principal players is missing from the radar screen. And the US documents are blank. Have RAW agents in huge numbers present in every nook and corner of Afghanistan and moving up and down the Pakistan-Afghan border been grazing grass all these years? So I think what he's saying there is that there seems to be a great deal of intelligence information actually missing, particularly with the you know, from the side of India.
Well, yes, I mean, let's face it. I mean, this is a trawl of documents, which is not all the documents that are possible to trawl. I mean, there is suggestions that this is a some kind of controlled leak. And that certain things are being highlighted and other things are not being highlighted.
Well, this is
for example, that, yeah, apparently there's nothing about the drugs trade in any of these documents, which is quite extraordinary, really, considering that Afghanistan is the major producer of heroin in the world. So there must be documents about the drugs trade, but we haven't seen them. And I think it's going to take quite a long time for people to go through all of these documents and see what they actually add up to. But of course, it's not the full story about anything. The full story is much bigger, and there's all sorts of other things that need to be put into the picture if you're going to get a full picture of what's going on.
Now, Guy, what's your thoughts about the principle of sites like WikiLeaks and Cryptome and the idea of being able to leak things on the internet?
Broadly, I think it's a very good idea. I think whistleblowers should be encouraged, and they should be supported and protected from bullying governments. Having said that, like everything in life, it's never really just that simple. I mean, there are things that do need to be kept quiet, and there needs to be a degree of responsibility about anything that is leaked. So providing, I think it's a good idea to embarrass governments when they're trying to cover things up that are simply face-saving. If lives are going to be put at risk, or livelihoods and people's futures put at risk, then there is a tremendous social responsibility on behalf of those involved in the leaking process. So it needs a balance, but broadly speaking, a very good idea.
Do you ever have time to look at these sites yourself, since you must spend quite a lot of time on the internet?
I wish. I do look at Wikipedia a little bit, and I do even try to contribute very, very occasionally. I haven't found my way over to WikiLeaks yet, and I think the prospect of there being over 92,000 documents is a little bit off-putting, isn't it? It's rather trying to read the Maastricht Treaty or something.
Well, John Young was really rather annoyed, and one of the reasons he left WikiLeaks was because they were getting funded around about £50 million a year, and he felt that actually all that was needed was something like £100 a month to run a website like he had run, and that there was people like George Soros funding WikiLeaks actually compromised it. Martin, what do you think? It actually matters who funds a site like this?
Well, I mean, there should be transparency about how things happen. I mean, the danger is that if there is a large amount of money involved, that the thing is being steered in a certain kind of direction. Obviously, you do need money to do anything, but there should be transparency and people should know where the money's coming from and how much is involved. And, of course, another thing, coming back to an earlier point, one of the questions that have been asked is quite a lot of informants inside Afghanistan have been named in these documents, and that's extremely irresponsible. Because a lot of these people might be assassinated, for example, and that doesn't seem to me to be right. I mean, you surely must cover the names up of people who've been, you know, the senior people have not been named, but people on the ground, Afghans, have been named, and of course it's much more dangerous for them than senior people.
Do you think it's pure paranoia then to think that an intelligence service could set up a kind of leaks website?
Well, of course that's what's likely to happen, isn't it? When something like this exists and it's a mechanism for getting, you know, stories spread, intelligence services are going to be massively interested in that, aren't they? I mean, they're going to be either want certain things to not be on it, or they might be making sure that certain things are on it. So as many people have commented, these documents seem to be setting Pakistan up as some kind of fall guy, and that the documents all seem to be pointing in that sort of direction. And so there is a question, well, maybe whoever leaked the documents was implying that was what they wanted people to learn. But of course, it needs to be analysed. You can't just presume that you know what it's all about unless you've read through it.
Well, it's 5:30 now, and time to take a break from our news review and to hear our guest Guy Kingston's choice of music. Now, Guy, what's the song and why did you choose it?
Well, it's Jenny Jones by The Clash. And like many businessmen, many business owners of my age, I'm into 70s punk, and I was a rebellious teenager, didn't like to conform, still don't to a certain degree, and that's one.
Did you have spiky hair?
I tried and never succeeded. It all just flopped and went curly and frizzy, and now I haven't got much hair left at all.
Okay, so let's have a listen to that. It's Jenny Jones by The Clash. Jones and The Clash. You're listening to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. Martin Summers, me, Tony Gosling, and Guy Kingston from the Federation of Small Businesses. That was Janie Jones, The Clash, 1977. Before we go back to our news review, a reminder quickly of our appeal from 50 families in St George who are part of the preschool playgroup at the Baptist Church. They need a new venue after having their lease unexpectedly terminated. So if you think you can know of somewhere that may be suitable, please contact St George councillor Ron Stone. Or you can email me here at BCFM. That's tony@bcfm.org.uk and I'll forward your message on to him. And I'll give you Ron's number just before the 6 o'clock news. Now, back to our news review, and the majority of fares are set to go up on Sunday for first bus in Bristol. The adult, single and return tickets will increase by 10 pence, although those bus fares already costing more than £4 will be held at their current level. Even the tickets that are intended to reward loyalty to first bus are set to go up, with rises in first week, first month and first year tickets. Managing Director of First Bristol, Somerset and Avon, Tony McNiff, said the past year has been incredibly tough for all businesses in the UK as the recession has taken its toll on everyone. Now, Guy, I wonder if you can just start with this. Do you think it's a reasonable service we're getting on first bus? And it must be quite difficult as businesses are actually not able to pay people more, that they're now having to pay more to travel on the bus.
Well, of course, fares going up, it's a bit like the banks. Who's going to say, yes, it's a good idea the fares go up, unless, of course, you're a shareholder in the bus company or the train company's putting the fares up. Personally, I think local transport services around here are dire. Where I live in Long Ashton, we have these huge great buses come thundering through with about three people on. Why don't they use a minibus? Be a lot more environmentally friendly. They could run the service a lot more frequently, and by doing it more frequently, they'd have many more passengers. It would be a service worth using. Why I have to go into the centre of Bristol, buy a second ticket to go up Park Street is nuts. My solution is these people need some competition.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I think the problem with competition in this kind of field is that it's not naturally a competitive market. A local bus company tends to be a local monopoly, whether it's owned by the council or whether it's run as a private concern. And competition isn't the answer to all problems. Certain kinds of industries are suitable for competition, and those industries are often got to small producers, lots of different producers, and therefore there's a natural competition there. Other industries, because of economies of scale, are simply not competitive industries. Frankly, if you go to the continent, you will find that the local municipalities run the buses and they subsidise them as well, because of course they're looking for a knock-on effect in terms of economic growth for their city. So I went to Bologna in the 1970s when the Clash were singing, as we heard earlier, and of course the local council in Bologna, which was controlled by the communists, had subsidised the buses, so the buses were about 10p, and people got on and off the buses, and they zoomed around, and it was quite a successful setup. But of course, the anarchists didn't believe in paying any money, so they would go onto the buses and break the machines where you put your 10p, and in a sense, they were right, because it doesn't make sense to collect 10p off people. It's more problematic than just letting them get on and off. And I understand that there's another story that we might look at later about a campaign for free public transport for Bristol. Now, that sounds utopian, but if you think about it, if you've got free public transport, that means that your city becomes extremely desirable for locations for investment and so on.
You're quite right, Martin, looking ahead there. The Bristol Campaign for Free Public Transport will be holding its first meeting in South Bristol on Monday the 23rd of August at 7 p.m. at Redcatch Community Centre. And everyone is welcome. The objectives of the campaign are to defend the free bus pass for the over 60s, to extend free public transport to children, young people, the unemployed and those in receipt of income support, and to secure public ownership of the public transport system, its expansion, full integration and rational planning. Now, Guy, do you think this is a bit pie in the sky?
Well, we'd all love to be able to travel free, wouldn't we? But it's got to be paid for somehow, and that is going to mean through taxation. If you're the person getting the free transport and someone else is paying for it, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul, you're always going to get Paul's vote.
It would certainly encourage people to leave their cars at home, wouldn't it?
Yes, but I think the bus service has to be one that is worth using. I mean, if public transport were as good as private transport, we'd all be on public transport, but you have to wait a long time. The services don't go where you want them to go to. You've got no control over who you sit next to or whether you actually get a seat. There are a lot of undesirable things. And in a society that's developing and becoming richer with higher standards of living, people want the comfort and luxury afforded by private transport. And if we're not going to live in the past, we need to accept the fact that people want that, and we should provide the facilities for them. And just to come back, if I may, quickly on Tony's point. Martin's point, yes. I saw this private service in Moscow when I was living there in the 1990s. Some savvy business owners bought a few Ford transit vans, minibuses, and they stuck the same number on the front as the bus routes, and they'd run up, and people would pay a fare, and they'd jump in, and they'd go off, and they filled a gap. And it did work. And I think we small business owners could make a real difference if we had just one or two routes, take on the big boys, give it. It's worth trying. It's worth trying rather than just saying it's a natural monopoly, it can't work. I think we should give it a go.
Well, I mean, basically, public transport virtually everywhere is subsidised by the taxpayer, directly or indirectly. Many of the routes that First Bus is running, for example, are subsidised by the council. And I would say that there is no case, really, for subsidising something which makes a profit. There is no case.
Absolutely.
Now, the Evening Post website has gone ballistic on this story, and there's loads and loads of comments. I'll read out a few of them. Now, first one, at a recent consultation for a showcase bus route, I complained about First Bus and the cost of their fares. The council officer asked me, if I were First Bus, would I prefer to carry one passenger and charge them £1 million, or carry a million passengers at £1 each? That's what First Bus is aiming for, more or less. That was David, who says, I'm not living in a democracy. Another comment, I work in the centre of Bristol and have become somewhat reliant on the number 36 bus, which must be one of the most unreliable routes in the city. No apologies when it's late, and certainly no comment from First when it simply doesn't arrive. I still have the pleasure of paying £2.35, now going up to £2.45, to get to the middle of town when it does eventually turn up. Get rid of First and bring back the Bristol Omnibus Company and the green double-deck buses. And another one. Our weekly shopping trip to the centre, my friend and I take a taxi both ways. It's cheaper and it goes door to door. Having said that, something is dreadfully wrong when two travelling by taxi is cheaper than going by bus. The general public used to be protected from profiteering private monopolies by law. It seems to me the line between big business and serious organised crime has been removed. Guy.
Well, I do think First is an appalling, the bus service side of the business anyway, is an appallingly run outfit. The website's very user unfriendly. They seem to be inefficient, not customer focused. And if they are going to get any form of public subsidy, then I think they need to be accountable in terms of the quality of service that we as consumers or as taxpayers funding that are getting from them. Otherwise, I would take the money away and put it to give it to someone who's going to give us a better service.
So should we boycott the buses?
I don't think you can do that, can you? I mean, I mean, lots of people haven't got cars. I mean, pensioners and so on. I mean, you do need to have a public transport as infrastructure.
But if we had a second bus, a competitive bus on the same route, then you could boycott First and go on the other one,
bus.
But two firms in an industry is not competition. That's a duopoly, and they will have a collusive pricing policy.
Now, we're going to have a little listen now to a film from this is from 1951. This is the way things used to be under the Bristol Omnibus Company.
Bristol, seaport, university town, industrial centre, whatever you care to call it. It's crowded and full of people on the move. People who have to queue for the bus and don't like it. Some people even go so far as this.
Dear sir, I really must draw your attention to the disgraceful bus service on the number 22 route.
Last Tuesday evening I had to wait at least 20 minutes for a 22 bus at Temple Meads, etc, etc. Right. Garrett, I want you to investigate this complaint.
Right, sir.
Keith, I want you to do a four-hour check at Old Market. We need to analyse the loading there before we work out our winter schedule.
Yes, sir.
Brown and Pope?
Yes, sir.
I want you to check the loading at Victoria Rooms and then out to the aircraft works at 5 o'clock.
Very good, sir.
To improve matters, it's essential to find out the actual performance of the services from R to R. The bus observers are the fact finders of the system, expert in detecting and recording the facts that reveal the weak places in the service. It's largely their work that enables us to deal with this kind of criticism from the public and adjust the service to the best advantage. For the public must be served at slack times as well as at busy ones, and it's not always easy to do both. But when the pile-ups and the gaps have been checked and located, then something can be done about them. But in bus work, nothing ever pans out quite as it ought to. So there's always a relief crew to deal with the unexpected snag. They have the consolation of sitting in the canteen with the off-duty men. But they never know where they're going or when the bus will be needed.
Traffic's very heavy on the 3, sir. Could we have relief?
Right,
go. Smith, driver Smith, conductor Gregory, get the bus ready for Whitchurch, will you?
Watchfulness and care can do much to ease the flow of traffic and meet the needs of those who depend on public transport.
There we have a British transport film from 1951 where they came and had a look at the way that the Bristol Omnibus Company was run. I think I better give you the final word on this, Martin. I mean, is there really any prospect of actually having a renationalised bus system here Bristol, where we don't actually have fat cat bosses taking big profits and shareholders taking profits out of the system?
Well, I can't see that the current government are going to think in that sort of way. And what's rather disturbing is that we've had a Labour government for 13 years and they didn't think in that kind of way either. You see, a lot of things that were done, like the privatisation of the bus services, are basically wrong, like the privatisation of the railways. It was a wrong move. But, of course, they've not had the courage to actually say, that's wrong, let's go back to the way we used to run it.
Surely in a democracy...
Because that's we're all going forwards and we can't go backwards. But it's actually, in fact... You know, some industries are better managed in the public sector than just are.
But surely in a democracy, we can look at the decision, say that was wrong, and we can change it, reverse it.
No, because you've now got vested interests in which build up, and they of course become a lobby in their own right. I mean, this is the argument against spending money on anything, because once you've spent money on something or you've taken a certain path, you've then created a vested interest which will block any further change. First Bus will fight like mad to keep its monopoly and to make sure that it carries on making money, and they're there now, and they are part of the equation.
So, staying with public transport, Bristol taxi drivers are to take the City Council to court next week over this blue paint ruling. Apparently, the local authority has told the city's 800 Hackney carriage drivers that they have to spray their cabs the colour of the famous Bristol blue glass. They were told this back in early 2008, but none of the major car makers produces the shade as a standard colour, and cabbies are saying that it will cost between £1,500 and £4,000, depending on the size and type of car, to change it. Guy, do you think this is fair to tell all the taxi drivers they've got to paint their cabs blue?
Well, I must confess, I don't know the Federation of Small Businesses line on this one, but it strikes me as nuts. It's going to cost a lot of money. Who's going to pay? It's just going to mean increased taxi fares, and that's not going to be popular, especially as maybe it will make the first buses cheaper to go to the supermarket on, won't it? Maybe that is all part of some huge conspiracy. I do think that having a uniform looking taxi is a good idea. In London, the taxis are black, they are all the same type of vehicle, and they're easy to identify, and I think that is a great advantage. This just looks a little bit of a ham-fisted way of doing it, and if we've got to celebrate Bristol's culture by painting taxis the colour of some glass, then I think we're getting a bit desperate, and maybe someone will be suggesting we have suspension-shaped bridge taxis next.
I think the cabbies are getting really worried about this, though, because both conditions apparently take effect from May the 1st next year. The council has said if cabbies don't comply, their licences will not be renewed. Shafiq Ahmed, who's the chairman of the National Taxi Association for Bristol and District, says, "We are going to court as a last resort." He also said that there was no consultation with the trade over respraying vehicles blue, which was also considered a high-risk colour because it's not so easily seen at night. Martin?
Well, I mean, I don't really know that much about this issue. It's the first I've seen of it. The main point I would make is that all markets, and this is a competitive market, I mean, you clearly taxi firms do fall into that category, but all markets require clear regulations that everybody understands, and transparent regulations. And if you think of the Hackney carriages in London, everybody recognises, and there are safety aspects as well. You want taxi drivers to be reliable people who are not paedophiles, rapists, what have you. And that does require some regulation. But you don't want to over-regulate an industry. You need as much regulation as you need to make sure that everything functions properly and no more. I think possibly this is a step too far.
Do you think that maybe the council are being control freaks here? It's just because they have the power to award licences, then they're going to be asking for more and more and
What it may be doing is reducing the number of people who can actually get into the business. It's a barrier to entry, isn't it? It's an extra cost. And that may or may not be a good thing. You don't want too many firms in the industry because, you know, basically nobody will be able to make any money. It seems to be a bit of control freakery, really. I mean, that's how it appears.
Okay. Now, we're going to go out onto the streets of Bristol now, and Marina Morris has been out asking you what you think about immigration.
Should there be a cap on immigration to the UK?
No, not necessarily. And it depends what you mean by immigration. Are we talking outside of EC? Are we talking inside the European community? We always have a moral obligation towards asylum seekers. I think that's important. And I think immigration is a two-way street. People can leave as much as come in. You know, it's not all about coming in.
In the EU, everybody should be able to sort of travel freely as they wish, but I think everybody should be expected to put something back into the economy, so you shouldn't be expected to take benefits if they are capable of working.
I'm from Zimbabwe, and I transferred here from South Africa 6 months ago. I'm an immigrant, and I think it depends, really. If the UK excuse that they need, surely they should let people come in, and there shouldn't really be a cap. I mean, if there's a shortage of skills.
Yes. Because the job situation, I know Eastern Europeans take a lot of the agricultural jobs, but maybe if they didn't, it would get some unemployed to do those jobs.
I think there should be a cap on immigration, not by any stretch of negative discrimination or anything like that, but I think that the country's populated as enough, is overpopulated, and we're running out of housing for British citizens living in the UK. And so there's that feeling of unfairness that seems to be quite prevalent across society. I think there should be better monitoring of those that actually do come into the country, and certainly they should all be able to speak a certain standard of English as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of positive value that the UK has already seen from immigration, and I think it sends out a very negative message. Any sort of discussion of caps in that regard, I think it's essentially a negative message to send out to what is, I think, a very positive thing that's happened over the last few years.
One in four children born in the UK last year had an immigrant mother. Is this good or bad?
Britain's a very international country. You can't have been a country that has a commonwealth of 57 countries and not accept immigration. It's a two-way street.
Today I'm reasonably indifferent, I think it's nice to live in a sort of quite a multicultural country, and I don't really have an opinion on that one either way. I think it's fine.
I think it is a good thing in that the community becomes more cosmopolitan if there's, you know, more people coming in. But I think also on the flip side, surely there should be control in a way, because the country can only support a certain number of people, and if we become too overcrowded, there'll be pressure on social services. So it's really a double-edged sword.
I think it's good to have a multicultural country, but I still think there should be a limit.
If they're able to stay open-minded and to rear that child in a way that, with love, you know, and care and all these things, then I believe that that's the main thing.
Now, Guy, that was Marina Morris there out on the streets of Bristol this week asking about immigration. What's the sort of business people's position on this? Because do you think there is actually really a skill shortage, and that we really need people to be coming in from abroad?
Well, we want to be able to employ the best people for the job. And as a business owner or as an employer, you don't really mind where they come from. You just want to get the best that you can. And where there are barriers to that, that can prove a problem. I think what's a real grievance for business owners is the hoops that we have to jump through to prove that the people we're employing are entitled to be here. Someone gives us a fake passport that looks perfectly genuine, somehow we're at fault. And how am I supposed to know whether a passport or a visa is legitimate or not?
Now, is it the best people that businesses want or the cheapest?
Well, best can mean low cost, at least in part. You want the best value, don't you? And that's a combination of skills and affordability. We all like to be well off, and we all want to be paid a lot. But to do that, we have to have a productive economy. And if we pay bus drivers more, the bus fares are going to go up and we're all going to be moaning. So we have to look at things both ways. If we want our strawberries and Sainsbury's to be cheap, they have to be picked cheaply, don't they?
Martin?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think all countries have to have some control over who is allowed and who is not allowed to come into the country. I mean, it's absurd to imagine otherwise.
But why not? Why can't we just have free movement around the world? What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, I used to live in Poland, and I remember talking to a Polish girl. This was before the EU expansion, so Poland was outside the EU at that stage, saying, why can't I just come to Britain and work in Britain? I mean, I speak English perfectly well, and, you know, why can't I just go to Britain and get a job in Britain? And I said to her, you see over the border there, that's Russia. Do you want everybody in Russia to come and work in Poland? Oh, no. Ah, well, now you see what the problem is. And I'm not saying this is a potentially very tense question about who gets the right to work, what level of wages. We saw the strikes last year against, you know, for British jobs for British workers because they felt that they were being undermined by people coming in more cheaply. I think everybody has a right, you know, every country and every society has a right to protect itself from complete open doors with immigration. But on the other hand, I would say that we should have a liberal immigration policy in Britain for all the reasons that Guy was saying. We want the best people for the jobs. We are a cosmopolitan country, and that's we're going to need lots of young workers to pay our pensions because we're not actually reproducing enough young people. You know, basically, people come here to work are basically contributing to the country, and that's, you know, you can't complain about that. That's how it works.
But doesn't it mean that there's going to be more unemployed people who were born here, or more domestic people, and that actually is increasing the burden?
There isn't just a finite amount of work available. If you manage things properly, everybody should be able to work. It's been mismanagement of the macroeconomy that's led to mass unemployment.
Now, local authorities are threatening legal action over the axed school buildings programme. At least two councils are taking steps to sue the government in the High Court over the cancellation of multi-million pound contracts to build new schools, it emerged yesterday. Local authorities attacked the Education Secretary, Michael Gove, for refusing to give them answers over whether new buildings for the thousands of pupils would eventually go ahead. Guy?
Well, I've been to a couple of fairly new schools in the last year or two, and they both struck me, they both felt like rather modern young offenders institutions, and they're not meant to be.
But why do you say that?
Well, just the atmosphere. It was soulless, and I think that does affect people's education. I think we have been wasting vast sums of money in the buildings that we've been putting up. What I'm trying to say is, clearly, we do need schools. We need them to be comfortable. We need them to be modern. We need them to be well-equipped to do the job. I don't think we need to spend so much money building such monstrosities. I think we could build a lot nicer schools for far less money. So we could get two great schools for the cost of one bad school.
Well, what about this specific programme? Because many schools around the country, not at least which around here in Bristol, were actually planning at the end of the summer holidays to maybe even have been in new premises. And now they're now told that that money is not going to be there.
Well, as far as I understand, those programmes that were already committed to going ahead, where the contracts have been signed, can still go ahead. Clearly the previous building programme had got out of control and it needed some reining back. Whether Mr Gove has gone too far or possibly even not far enough is maybe a different debate. Certainly if you're hoping to send your child to a school that has yet to be built or was about to be renovated and hasn't been, you're going to be disappointed. But it was costing us more money than we can afford, and cash is tight. We've got to be realistic about this.
Martin?
Yeah, I think this whole idea that cash is tight is, I think, a macroeconomic mistake. We need, in fact, public investment to restart the economy. The private sector and exports will not lead. Everybody can't export their way out of a depression, which is effectively what the policy is at the moment, as agreed at the G20 summit in Toronto. We're all going to take in each other's washing, is effectively what's being suggested. This injection of cash and building, the construction industry is on its back. So building these buildings, however, I mean, obviously we want good buildings rather than bad buildings. I mean, I think we can agree about that. But the spending of the money puts people to work.
But Martin,
and
we're
then
being told.
Then they go and spend money in the shops.
Martin, we're being told that the money is simply not there.
Yes, we are being told that. It's very interesting. The most interesting thing that's happened in the last couple of weeks is that Standard & Poor's and the other credit rating agencies, who are actually, there's a lot of questions about how independent they are and how sensible they are and whether they should be allowed to actually decide all these who's credit worthy and who's not. But the most interesting thing that's happened is that they've all said, because the government is cutting the deficit or trying to cut the deficit, they're going to mark down Britain's debt because they don't believe that cutting the deficit is possible. And as we've seen in Ireland over the last 2 years, they've been cutting the deficit, supposedly cutting public expenditure, and the deficit has got bigger, because that's what happens when you try and cut a deficit in a depression. This is what people used to know. After the Second World War, Conservative governments would not have cut public expenditure at this moment. They wouldn't have done it. We've now had a generation of free market fetishism, but it's all wrong.
Now, do you want to come back on that, Guy, or have we got one more story here?
Well, I think I just have to disagree that we can carry on spending money. We would just not be able to finance our deficit if it wasn't curtailed to some extent. We can argue about the extent that it is curtailed, but it was just getting too much.
Okay, so our final story of the week. Wheat soars to limit on Russia export halt. So Chicago wheat futures soared yesterday, setting up the permitted daily maximum for the first time in 2 years, after number three exporter Russia said it would temporarily halt all grain shipments. Martin.
Well, I mean, it's the heat wave in Russia that's led to this price surge. But of course, one of the problems we've got is that speculators go into these markets for commodities and create bubbles. And this is quite possibly another bubble.
Well, my tip of the week, pop down to your supermarket and stock up on loads of flour, because it's going to go up in price.
Why do you say that? You think, I mean, obviously this is going to push it up, but surely this may only be a temporary thing. Well, the Russian, I mean, it's actually quite a serious thing for a country to say, right, we're not actually exporting any wheat. Well, they're the third biggest producer in the world.
But they only have one grain harvest a year, and so there's going to be a shortage for 12 months at least. I have family in Russia, and it's terrible what's happening over there, and I think the Russian government are being very sensible putting their people first. But the rest of us, flour's going to get more expensive, bread's going to get more expensive.
The real problem is going to be in developing countries where people are dependent on this food source.
Okay, well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. As promised, the number for Ron Stone is 0117 977 9169. That's 977 9169. Thanks to this week's guest, Guy Kingston from the Bristol branch of the Federation of Small Businesses. After the news, it's a part one of our report into Northern Ireland and Helen Reid.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.